Hi, I'm Hannah.
And I'm Kira.
This is a BBC Sherlock podcast, where we are doing a Watsonian analysis of the show, series 1 through 4.
Whether you're initiated, a veteran fan, or just wondering why series 4 was like that, we have you covered.
Listen to our discussion as we play The Great Game. Welcome, everybody. Today, we're going to talk about episode 2, The Blind Banker, which I'm going to try my best to pronounce that correctly today. I always want to say baker, but I'm going to say banker.
It's okay. We know what you mean.
And the title, before we actually get into the episode proper, we really want to talk about the title specifically, which is, it comes from, it's not a story in canon at all. It's a poem written by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. So it's called The Blind Archer. That title on its own is a lot, but should I read the whole thing or maybe just a few key lines?
I think all you need to do is read the few key lines, because it's really all you really need.
Yeah, I'll read the first like section and then see if there's anything else that's particularly... Ooh, I did see one line that's pretty good. So the first, whatever you call it, stanza, verse, I don't know what you call it. but it goes, little boy love, so Cupid is essentially... drew his bow at a chance, shooting down at the ballroom floor. He hit an old chaperone watching the dance. And oh, but he wounded her sore. Hey, love, you couldn't mean that. Hi, love, what would you be at? No word would he say, but he flew on his way, for the little boy's busy, and how could he stay? And some other telling lines, or like maybe lines that they could have gotten something from it. There's one that says, he winged an old veteran drinking his port, and down that old veteran fell. The king sought a bride, and the nation had hoped for a queen without rival or peer, but the little boy shot, and the king has eloped with Miss No One on nothing a year.
I never thought about that one.
I know, I didn't think about it either. I was thinking like the priest one sooner, which is where exactly? I don't see it anymore. Oh, yes, I skipped it. A sad-faced young clerk was, and then something, was planning a celibate vow. And the boy's random arrow has sunk in his heart, and the cell is an empty one now. So what do we think?
I love it.
Yeah.
No, it's crazy. I think it's really interesting that they chose to, this is the only episode that they didn't name it after one of the stories of Sherlock Holmes canon. Mm-hmm. And this is, it's just very, very interesting.
Yeah. I wonder if they took inspiration from it, or if
they have gotten the name. And it's an Arthur Conan Doyle poem.
No, I meant like specific details in it. Like the veteran drinking and the celibate, like, or was he thinking about Holmes and Watson when he wrote it, or was it just like a total coincidence?
I think maybe. I think it's possible that he was. We don't know for sure.
We don't know. It's all kind of like circumstantial, I guess. But
if anything, it tells us that at least Muff and Gittes were thinking that he was talking about Holmes and Watson.
Right. Because you can make some parallels.
Yeah.
The celibate vow, the old veteran drinking his port, it's just so, oh, it's a lot. And they put and this is the second episode after the first episode, pilot had them showing the title with Cupid or whatever it was, or something similar to Cupid. It was not technically Cupid, but it looked like Cupid, so you would assume. So that's like already something they were thinking of there, and then they included this poem. It's a lot, and they change. I like that they use blind, so it's almost like, well, not almost like, it does in the poem, it implies that that it was not in the plan for these people.
It wasn't expected.
And it seems, quote unquote, illogical. Like it's unrequited, or it's a priest with a celibate vow. Like, they're not, this is not something that should happen, but it does anyway. Because it's just, it's kind of like accusing. It's accusatory. Like, you're just blindly shooting at people out of like anger. Like, this wasn't supposed to happen to me, and I'm in love and I'm mad about it. Or maybe it's unrequited. Like, it could go either way. I think you could look at it multiple.
Yeah, and it happens to be that coincides perfectly with the current emotional sort of relationship journey with John and Trollek in this episode.
Yes. Yes, and we're going to get into that. And they changed Archer to Banker. And it just occurred to me, because the word Archer, they use it multiple times, or they used it with Scandal, like Mr. Archer on the count of three, shoot Dr. Watson. And then this one, it kind of makes me think, solidifies my opinion that the banker is slightly more supposed to be John than Sherlock in this. We'll get into why. We'll get into why later. We're going to talk about that a lot at the end. At the beginning, the first scene, like the cold open, so to speak, we get these teapots and beautiful music that plays over top of it. And the teapots, she's like pouring tea, I believe, on top of the teapots, and she's making tea. And I don't remember exactly, but you have the transcript. Is there anything like that we should note about what she's saying in that opening speech?
I know she talks about, so I think part of her job is to take care of the teapots. So these teapots, they're old teapots that sort of require to be used constantly in order to keep their beauty and their patina nice and shiny. Something that she says that I really love is that some things aren't meant to sit behind glass. They're meant to be touched, to be handled. So in this case, the constant use of this ancient sort of artifact is keeping it alive. It's keeping it beautiful. So I think we can sort of see a little bit of a parallel to the ACD canon stories. Like, they're not meant to just sort of sit in history. They're meant to be toyed with and to be constantly, you know, retouched and handled.
That's a good point. Like, it's not even just reusing them. Like, you're just using it to make tea, because if you just make tea, you're only working with the inside, right? She pours the tea on the outside of it.
It's more of a ritual too. It's like a ceremony. Yeah,
exactly.
It's not just like making tea.
Right. You're not just making tea. You're not just taking the old stories and reusing them. You're meant to touch them, handle them, like you're changing it. You're really working with the pot and not just trying to get the tea. So it's layered. And then there's also a parallel even just with Su Lin, who we'll talk about more maybe later, with the fact that she's a Sherlock mirror, because that is her work and she doesn't want to be distracted by it, by going on a date. And then she's got other reasons why she doesn't want to, but that we can talk about that more later. And then the second part is this. I don't know if this is the scene where we tend to get a lot of our drink code. It's not the whole thing for drink code, but a lot of people interpret it as like, that's the romantic element, the gaiety, as they say. And I don't necessarily think it's just from this scene, but this is like the foundation for it. And I think it's really just what comes later. I think that the teapot metaphors, the stories, is what you're really supposed to focus on at the beginning. And then the meant to be touched and handled part is a lot. But I think that the gay tea subtext or whatever metaphor, I think you don't really think about it until you see later in the show, in the episode, where it's behind glass, right? It's not meant to sit behind glass. And then Sherlock is looking at them, and he's standing on the other side, looking through the glass at the teapots. And so it's very much layered with meaning there. The glass itself, how do we describe the symbolic meaning of glass? I feel like I intuitively understand it, but I don't know how to describe it.
Yeah, I'm not really sure, honestly. I mean, God, I know it's in series four. It comes up in series four in like the biggest way.
Yeah.
And I forget exactly what it is that we talked about with it. I know it was like the glass was fake. There was no glass. There was like elephant
proof shot glass. Well, it started, I can't remember if there's any other use of it, but I know in Abominable Bride, the glass breaks. And then in series four, in the last episode, it's elephant glass or whatever. And then all of a sudden it wasn't there. So the glass isn't really there. But I think in this scene, I can't think of any other use of glass, but that particular moment, though, it's really just the glass, I think, is maybe just what is stopping you from touching,
interacting with it in a meaningful way.
Exactly. Yeah. You're just looking in on it, not.
You're just observing like an old artifact and you're not interacting with it anymore.
Right. You're not making the tea with it, keeping it nice.
You know, continuing the ritual. And you could also say it's like continuing the ritual of the Great Game. As well,
that's a good point. Yeah, you're working with you're playing the game, you're working with it, you're tinkering, you're looking for more things, trying to get meaning out of it rather than just reading them,
rather than just making another adaptation, you know.
Yeah, like that kind of goes, yeah, and it goes back to the what we said in the first episode, and we probably keep repeating it, where you're not just taking it out and slapping, you know, giving the main hero an iPhone, you're right. There's a point to it. They're modernizing it with a point. They're trying to correct something. They're saying something about the original story. It's not just taking a new, this character and changing it and making it a new character on like their version of it. They're looking at the old stories and working with them and looking for meaning in them to then bring it into the present and like make it new and get rid of those cracks and not keeping it behind glass. It's a good point. I think that wraps up that metaphor quite nicely.
Yeah. You know, I don't want to go too much into it, but I'm just thinking about the tea and coffee metaphor. Mm-hmm. We didn't really get into that quite yet. I don't know if we should.
No, I don't think we really need to. I think we'll...
Yeah, I'm not really sure. It's weird because I've never really fully been super convinced of it. The only thing that really convinced me of the coffee tea metaphor was when Moffat and Gatiss did that Q&A.
Oh, yeah.
On Tumblr, and they're like...
Steven handles the tea.
Yeah.
Or no, like, Mark handles the tea.
Mark, yeah, I handle the coffee. I prefer coffee. Mark handles the coffee. Tea.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I was like, wow, okay. maybe it's there.
I think it is. I don't think it's super important, honestly. No, it's just kind of like a fun thing that they ran with, maybe. But I think a lot of people have a problem with it, but I think that's because we're trying to make it fit too perfectly, and it doesn't have to fit too perfectly to still be true. You know?
Yeah, it really doesn't fit super perfectly. No. And that's why people in England make tea.
It's more just about how it's used. Like, you can have blue curtains in a scene and it doesn't have to mean anything, but if you're in the right context, it can mean something, you know. So I think it's if we go too far in looking at each example and overanalyzing them out of context, you can put too much meaning into it, or the opposite, where you're like, well, no, I don't think so because this, and then you're really just kind of going back and forth for no reason. I think it's, you really can just look at it as this moment has weight put on it, or it's used in a way that's odd or stands out to you, and there's a through line, so I think there's a connection here, and not every example has to necessarily mean something.
Yeah, and again, I don't want to make this forever, But the one thing I think that really does stand out to me with regards to instances of coffee and tea is the one in his last vow with Janine. When she's like, oh, could you be in love and put some coffee on? And then she is also like moved the coffee and John. Everything, I don't want to go into that, but
yeah,
just put a pin in that. Okay. And then I'll talk about that later.
Okay. I'll try to remember that, but
trust me, I'll remember it. I love that scene.
Yeah, you do love that scene. I love that scene too, but I feel like everyone seems to love that scene a lot more than me. I do love it. I just don't lose my mind over it. I don't know why.
I lose my mind over it.
I think we all have our own. We all have our pet favorite scenes where we just can't stop thinking about it.
Yeah, there's a few scenes that I feel the same way as you do about that. Yeah. Like, I'm like, I don't know. It's not like that much.
Or like, me, I get it. I feel you. It's true. You're right. But also, I don't know. I'm not like, ooh, I'm not going crazy over it. I think that's probably just my scene where I totally get what people are getting at. And if someone were to ask me to analyze it in super intense detail, I think I could. And I would feel confident, but I'm not like...
I think once I talk about it, when we get to his last film, maybe you'll feel differently.
Maybe.
Because I have a lot to say about that scene.
Okay. I'm excited. I'm excited then. Ooh.
Get excited.
Yay.
Okay.
Okay, let's move on. I'm sure we will talk about this throughout the rest of the show quite a bit. But I think that we needed to stop and pause because that teapot scene is just so, there's so much emphasis put on it that we just have to talk about it. So after like the end of the credits, we get like back and forth between Sherlock fighting some random person in the flat and then John fighting the register, the cash register, the chip and pin machine. He hit a row.
Yeah, yes, the self checkout for America.
There's all, yeah. that's what I was thinking of. Yeah, and the there's layers to this, but so it sets up a lot of things that John does not have money right now, so he can't buy groceries. He can't buy the food, which is loaded on its own. He can't buy the food because he doesn't have money. He needs to get a job, and he's fighting the machine. He's not just like ugh. He's actively frustrated and mad, and then because then later he says, or Sherlock says, "You had a row with the machine," which is because he clearly. In Sherlock is a machine, right?
Because John said, he did say, he's like, I had a row with the chip and pin machine. And
then John
had a row with the machine. Mm-hmm. But I love Sherlock in that moment because he just looks so, like, amused and,
he's
like, charmed
so
by John.
So charmed, yeah.
Like, just...
we like, all just kind of are. Adorable. John always gets... He's got such a temper, and it's one of his, like... Which is why they're both meant for each other, because they both have the most toxic traits, and yet, or like not toxic traits, but slightly more negative traits, like we all do. And they they both find each other's faults charming.
Yeah, I know.
There's a limit where they also get frustrated with each other, but then they can't help but be like charmed.
Enamored by how off putting they are.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Because they see through their bullshit, you know? For the most part. Yeah. Not always, but yeah. So, and then also that scene starts the first of a trend where John is in a string of very bad luck through the whole episode. Mm-hmm. He just keeps, there's reasons for it. Like he doesn't have a job, or he wasn't thinking in this scene, or he did this other thing. There's always like a reason
or
for
he gets,
it.
Or he but gets accused of spray painting.
Right.
They've given me an ASBO.
Mm-hmm. And then at the end, he's frustrated with Sherlock, and so he's like mocking him. And then it turns out, oh, they think I'm him now, and because of all these random circumstantial things, the universe has conspired against me, and now I'm in this tough spot. So this is like. That's a huge running theme throughout the whole rest of the episode. He just keeps having bad luck, and the whole universe, like chance, circumstance, just keeps getting him down. And I think that's a really, I didn't really stop to think about this until the other day, because I think I'm like actively trying to think of where things could be relevant to series five, like in terms of symmetry, because the first season is so important for that. And I think that there's got to be some sort of subversion to that, because the first episode, we have a John Mirror that dies from falling victim to chance, right? That 50-50 chance sort of idea. So that mm-hmm. has to come back in some way. So I connected that in my mind, where I don't think it's really chance, but it happens. There's always like a reason. Usually, I mean, not like him getting rusted was definitely just bad luck, but there's always some sort of a reason for why things happen. But there's so many examples of them that you can't help but think that he's just got really bad luck and bad things just keep happening to him all at once. And it's like, oh, I was thinking about how in his last vow, he says, because there's always like there's choices, like your choices will have consequences. And he just always seems to have bad luck with chance, because he will somehow manage to choose wrong. And even in A Study of Pink, he chooses the wrong building. Like there's the two buildings, like the Roland Kirk Community College, the two buildings, just like the two pills, he picks the wrong building. And then in his last vow, Sherlock tells him, like when they're talking about Mary, like, why did this happen to me, basically? Because you chose her. And he's like, why is everything always my fault? Why? He's just, and I think that's a hugely important theme going into series four for him. That's where he's at.
Yeah, he's like, I think it sort of establishes him as also being taken for granted.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Okay, that was my soapbox. Let's move on. Oh, okay. So, and we see that like taken for granted part a lot more, because, and then when we get back to 221B, John and Sherlock's relationship is very tense because of a variety of reasons, but Sherlock feels underappreciated in this moment, I think maybe because John's just so focused on what he's worried about and he's being rude. And because he's probably frustrated about things with Sherlock as well. And he's just starting to like really like him and trust him maybe. And is like, I don't know what to do, because now I feel like I'm questioning everything and I'm feeling underappreciated. And then it leads us to when they have to go, because he's like just about to ask Sherlock for money, like to borrow money from him. And then they go after he's been a total jerk the whole time. Just the one, like, yeah, Sherlock stole his laptop, but he's still just like being extra rude. And then he's like, so will you give me money? It's very like, John, honey.
But Sherlock seems, but the thing is, like, Sherlock seems very happy to do it for him. Like, he's just like,
right. Cause it doesn't,
he just like very softly, like, take my card.
And that's how that's how it starts too, I think.
Yes, this is how it starts. But then it goes downhill in the middle, because some shit happens. Get to it.
Yeah. And then they go to because Sherlock gets an email from a not very friendly friend from college, a person that he knows who like always thought he was making things up and was just rude to him. And now all of a sudden when they need his help, he is there. He's still gonna, like, now he believes Sherlock was telling the truth, and yet he just still can't let down his ego and believe him. And then Sherlock is still being nice. Like, he didn't have to do that. I don't think he had any real reason to believe that there was a worthy case to find there. I don't think. I think he went because it might be an interesting case, and B, I might as well be nice, but I don't know why he was all that.
And I kind of think that Sherlock knew that they would get good amount of money from it, and he knew John needed money.
I think that's
why he didn't take the money. He wanted John to take it.
Yeah,
I think this was like, I don't need your money. I think he knew John was gonna take
it. I think he was probably just on the fence, like, I don't know, it's probably not nothing, and I feel bad, but I also, maybe he'll be nicer to me now, and I'll have another friend, and he'll finally realize that I was right. And then he doesn't really want to go, but then John wants money, so okay, you know what, fine.
Then they go to see Sebastian, right? And Sherlock's like, this is my friend John Watson, and John's like, colleague. And it's just like
heartbreaking.
Ouch. John, ouch.
Ouch.
And I think at this moment Sherlock's like, oh, what? Wait, what? He starts to get this sense like, wait, like, why would he say that? I thought we were friends, you know?
Yeah.
And I think it just kind of goes downhill
from out here. There.
Yeah, and so, and then they're in the room, and you know, they're talking about the case, but then Sebastian starts talking about Sherlock. Yeah, like, you know, he knew him before, and he was like, I never believed him. He was, we thought he was like,
we all hated him. He says that we all hated him. How could you say that? Yeah, we all hated him
for it. And John's like agreeing with it, like, haha, I know what you mean. And Sherlock's like, he looks like down a little bit, like all sad.
This is definitely one of his toxic moments, because he just goes along with it as a joke. And it's not until Sherlock says, oh no, I was just talking to your secretary outside. And he doesn't tell him the real reason why he knows. He just laughs it off. And then that's when John goes, what? There's no way. And that's when he goes, oh shit.
But then they left, and he was like, he's like, you were making up about the secretary thing.
Yeah. But that's an important moment too for John, where he finally starts, he goes, oh, maybe I'm being a bit of a jerk, because now Sherlock is like, if I think this is funny and Sebastian thinks it's funny and Sherlock is blatantly lying because he doesn't want to get his feelings hurt, uh-oh. So that's an important scene. But it also sets up that we are supposed to connect John with the banker, I think. Maybe more heavily. I think there's definitely a case to be made there.
I love how it's in the person who wrote the transcripts, they put it in the transcripts that Sherlock turns his head away and looks down his face, momentarily filling with pain.
Yeah, there's quite a bit of moments of interpretation there.
Yeah.
I can tell they try to be objective, but sometimes if you look at someone's, but then again, you look at someone's face and they're sad, it's obvious. So maybe it's not. No, it is subjective. It's fascinating to read the descriptions. All right. So we get the case where there was a break-in. So there's no dead body, but there's just a mysterious symbol on the wall painted, and Sherlock doesn't know what it means yet, but he needs to figure out what it is, and they don't know how they got in. And so that's what they're hired to do, is figure how they broke in. But it turns into something bigger. They need to figure out why. Which is telling. Not how did they break in, but why did they break in, right? And so it's just so cute when he like is walking around the office and is like hopping up and down. And
I know it
like
is.
Popping in it's and out. Cute. It's just cute. And he's like totally serious though. Like he's doing it for a reason. But when you don't necessarily know why he's doing it, it's so funny and it's so cute. It's so cute. I love it. It's charming. The music.
And everyone's like looking at him like, what the fuck?
Like, what is he doing? Yeah. And the music they play is like upbeat and, you know, goofy. And it plays when there's like, more comedic moments, and so it's just really cute. I love that moment. All right, and so they figure out who the symbol was for, and they go to his apartment, Eddie Van Coon, and then that's when we get the line from John, like, is there any chance you're gonna let me in? So it's the first time he gets like left behind. And then Oh my god, there's so much to the scene.
Oh god, yeah, and then there's the moment, I mean, Miranda bring it up the two episodes ago, the moment where, like, Sherlock was being strangled by the acrobat. And then when he came out, like, Sherlock wasn't telling John what he was doing. He was just, like, his voice was just, like, kind of messed up, and John's like, oh, you've gone a bit croaky, you're getting a cold. It's just very cute.
Yeah. But that's another scene where John gets left behind.
But that's another theme, is that Sherlock seems to kind of not be letting or telling John about the cases, or not really letting him in on them.
Yeah, so he feels left behind, but there's a reason. Like, that's like the break-in concept, where someone broke in. Mm-hmm. And how did they break in? And John keeps breaking in and he doesn't want him to. So he's trying to, like, there's a keeping someone out emotionally. He's like examining the body, and he's like, there's a one point where he's talking about the suitcase, and he's like, no, I don't want to, whatever. He doesn't want to go through some guy's dirty underwear, and it's just their bickering and not getting along. And John, I don't even know. John's just being stupid, but John is angry that he's not being let in, but then he's also not helping his own case.
No, not at all.
And then Dimmick shows up. And so do we see him again?
I think we only see him in this episode.
I want to say that he had a cameo in Six Snatchers, though. Because I remember that I do remember there was like that rapid fire case solving at the beginning. We meet like Hopkins. There's another
star. We meet Hopkins.
Right. But I want to say that there was someone else. And I want to say it was him. I could be wrong. It could have been another dude, but I know that it was someone else.
Maybe. I don't know. I have to say, it's like my least watched episode.
Same.
Of all time.
So. But I've been looking through it lately. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep. He's in it. He had a cameo. Oh, shit. Wild, right?
Whoa.
I know. Why? But yeah, he's in that for like a second. And the only other episode he's in is Blind Banker. So. But yeah, he's kind of like Lestrade, but meaner. So he's not, they don't know each other at all. So it's a lot more like a slight John Muir there. And he's not buying, and I made a note that when Sherlock was explaining everything about how he didn't kill himself, it was a murder. It just made it look like a suicide, which is a lot on its own. He moves around, so he walks out of frame to like put his coat on, and we see like the camera is facing Dimmick looking off screen at Sherlock, and we see John center frame mostly, or maybe slightly off center, and behind John is a mirror, and then that through the mirror we see Sherlock talking. And I don't know if there's a meaning to that at all, but it was strange. It was a weird choice that they showed the mirror behind John and had Sherlock talking. It was just very specific. And I don't know. Just knowing the show, it feels like it could have a meaning, but, or like it's like a visual language that they're exploring, perhaps.
There might be. I don't remember. I used to know more about like some of the mirroring situations in this episode, but I don't know.
That's like, I just never thought about it. I don't know if it means anything, but I just noticed that it was odd and I never noticed it before. So there could be something there, or maybe not. But what happens after that? We see a little bit about Su Lin. I just noticed this time that she lives above or next to the Lucky Cat.
Yes.
I think I might have noticed it, but I never really, really processed that. So it just reminded me of like how in the Reichenbach Fall, their neighbors are all of us are secret assassins.
Oh, right.
You know, and I just think like, wow, of course she lives right next to it. She probably didn't know necessarily that's, she went to Chinatown. She chose to live there, but I don't think she thought that, had any idea that there would or could be someone next door. If you're trying to run away from people, you're not going to purposely move in right next door to them. You know, you want to keep your distance. But they probably went there specifically because they knew that she was there. So it's definitely a parallel there that I didn't
think of. Yeah, oh, absolutely. Yeah, there's definitely.
And it is something there with like, because I know a lot of people, and I tend to lean towards it. I don't think there's enough proof really to definitively say that Mary likes cats.
There is it's on in the Empty Hearse when Sherlock is looking at Mary and the words pop up about her. One of them is that she, I think, is a cat lover.
So it's a very small detail. I wouldn't think anything of it unless in that scene when they go into the store, the lady has the cat and says to John, your wife, she will like. She will like the cat. She's holding up the lucky cat and says,
John, oh my God.
Yes, your wife will like the lucky cat. I know, right?
Oh my
there's
God. Just,
there's a lot of subtlety there. And I don't know why. Like, why cat? Why cat? Why is it significant?
I know why, though. Because Mary likes cats. Sherlock prefers dogs.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Also, right. Also, John doesn't seem to like cats either in The Great Game.
That's right. Oh, that's right. I knew there was something about the cat there. I couldn't figure out what it was.
It's also a shaved cat, by the way. It's a shaved cat.
That's true. Okay. And then, but then, John thinks that the cat poisoned the lady. And it wasn't.
Oh, yep.
It was the gardener, which is... Or not the gardener, but they got it from the garden. It was the house boy.
Yeah.
It's not actually clear what that guy does, but...
No, it was the Botox. It was in the Botox.
It was in the Botox, but they took something from the garden, like some plant or whatever,
so that it could look
like she had cut her hand gardening. Because that was what it was supposed to look like, but it was actually the Botox.
Right.
So there's something there. That is a whole... We're going to have to put a pin in this because I don't have the answer and I genuinely don't know. But there's something about the use of poison in this show in connection with... John is usually involved somehow and I don't know how. I don't know if it's a metaphor. It's supposed to be maybe deconstructed in some way. And I just... There's something about it that I can't pin down. And
do you think it has something to do with the TDT?
The TD12?
TD12. Why am I calling it TDT? TD12.
It could be, yes. And I say that because the Lying Detective and the Hound of Baskerville are symmetrically opposite. And in Hound of Baskerville, we have
the gas
in the fog. Because I was looking at this the other day, where it makes people angry and paranoid. They see things that aren't there. It can affect memory because that's what happens to him. It affects his memory. And TD12 also affects memory. I didn't think anything of it too strongly. I knew there could have been a connection there. And like Maggie, Thatcher, the password, it's all. And then the fact that it was in Indiana and America, there's something about America there that and then Galverton said something about breaking America. I don't have the answers. I'm just I'm making connections and I'm losing it because I don't know why there's a connection.
I can't wait to get to season four. I can't wait to get to season four.
I know, but there's gotta be a connection. There's something about America and the way that it's referenced very specifically throughout the show that it's telling.
Do you think Mary's American or do you think she's a Czech?
I don't think it matters. I don't think it matters.
I know it doesn't matter, but...
Right. I think either she's American or she works for people in America or people involved in whatever is going on that we don't know about yet could be in America or related to America in some way. So whether she is literally American, it's a question, but we're not given an answer. But it is thrown in there.
I don't know. I think she might be. Well, I don't know. I'm just thinking about how... I don't know if you remember before series 4, Mark Gatiss was tweeting all these really cryptic things about sharks. And one of them was sharks pee sitting down, sharks drive on the wrong side of the road.
Oh, I get it. Because America, we drive on the quote unquote wrong side of the road.
They drive on the wrong side. No. Yeah, we drive on a... Or I don't know if it was the wrong side or they drive on the left side of the road or whatever.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
We have to look at it again. Someone will fact check us, probably.
Probably. At the right side of the road.
But back to what I was saying so that we can get this over with and go back to what we were talking about. I didn't notice it until I was looking through the transcript that they used the word paranoid. And, you know, it makes sense because Henry is very paranoid throughout the whole episode. And we are meant to... I think Henry functions as a Sherlock mirror in some ways, but I think more as a red herring, and that we're really supposed to connect him to John.
I think he's a John mirror for sure. 100%.
I think he's because he looks so much like him. They're in therapy. I think the red beard connection to Henry is again a red herring.
It is. In the commentary, the dude says that he's a John mirror. He actually says that.
He does?
Yes. Oh, the dude who plays Henry Knight. I have to find it out exactly what he says. He's like, I think there's a bit of a we dress kind of similar.
Oh, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So he is a John Muir, like, for sure.
And I remembered the line in The Abominable Bride. There's that conversation where they're talking about the brides, and they're talking about, they're going there to talk to Mycroft about the obliquity of the ecliptic. He talks about how there's enemies everywhere. And John, or Watson, is like, is it the socialists, the anarchists, the Scots? And Mycroft, Mark Gatiss, says, have you heard of recent studies into something called paranoia?
Oh, it sounds French, like, or something.
Does he say paranoia?
Yeah, absolutely, paranoia. But do you think the paranoia relates to, I guess, the Henry Knight thing? And
yeah, I think that's what it relates to. The what?
And the drugging, maybe?
Potentially, yes. Potentially. I think that I don't have an answer. I'm making associations so that we can think about it, you know?
I don't know if you saw on the meta that a few people talked about this, that there's a connection there's sort of a reference in The Lying Detective to another Arthur Conan Doyle story called The Parasite. And it's a story about a guy who's kind of like a John Watson character. I think it's more like a postulary. Please tell me if I'm wrong, but I think in it, I'm trying to remember exactly what it was, but there's a woman in the book who is mind controlling people, and she mind controls the main character to beat the shit out of his best friend in a scene that's very similar to the one from The Lying Detective. So there's like maybe a connection between Mary and mind control or something.
Something. Or he's paranoid, right? Because he gets the gun in Henry, and he's like shooting at what he thinks he's looking at, and it's not what it is. And there's also like maybe that's kind of what they're doing to like discredit him, like frame him. Because there's the line in The Hound of Baskerville where Sherlock says, dead men get listened to.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. He had to discredit everything he was saying. So that's why. Whatever it is. I don't know if he's... So they're setting him up to make it look like he shot Mary or whatever. Whatever that is. Because then there's also that one scene at the beginning of The Great Game. Where that's like supposed to be like a red herring. Like we're like thinking that maybe he did it on purpose. But it's actually... Whatever it is, he does something. And there's also the line in The Six Statures that I want to talk about. We are getting so off topic, but...
We really are. We're not even talking about the Blind Bank.
I know. Okay, let me just share this, and then that's like all I've really got. So,
okay.
This moment in The Six Statures where it's supposed to be like it's kind of like a double cross red herring, I think, maybe, possibly. Because Sherlock says to the guy that comes to his place that his wife is a Swedish spy, and and has been like across from like the American embassy, and has been like, I forget the exact wording, but like there's something with the drug there, but it's supposed to make him susceptible to manipulation or whatever. And then there's like the connection with John being used kind of like a puppet by Moriarty.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I never paid attention to that part because I only paid attention to like your wife is a spy who's been working for the American government for James Moriarty, which is another one.
Helps precipitate World War III. it's meant to be funny and ridiculous that you don't take it seriously.
I took it seriously when I first heard that. I'm like, oh my god.
Everything in that episode is a lie. Everything is always not what it seems. So we're supposed to take it the opposite way, actually. We are supposed to take it seriously. But I just think that there's all these different threads that are supposed to connect to each other, but we can't. I don't think yet we have. Maybe we haven't found it, or we haven't thought of an idea. There could be red herrings in there, or multiple ways of interpreting it, but there's definitely something there. It's like, and a lot of people had like an association with like the nurses. And remember when the nurses are pulling in the chairs with the IV bags, and like Mary that walks, like thought maybe Mary could have been one of them.
She looks like Mary. I don't know for sure.
Proof, but then there's the moment in The Six Snatchers where she's walking as like a flight attendant and she's like pushing someone in a wheelchair. So I can't help but draw a comparison. So there's something there. And I think it could be like a metaphor, or it could be literal. I don't really have a definitive.
I have no idea, but there's gotta be something there.
Yeah.
I guess only time will tell. But...
All right. We gotta get that on to the end.
I think we're zooming through this. So
yeah, we're almost halfway. Like I've like easily halfway through my notes. Oh, okay. So they had to go to the museum to talk to Andy about
what happened with Sulin.
I skipped the line where they said modern co-branking won't unravel it.
Hmm.
We have to go back to an ancient coding methods, right? So that's a love that line.
Yes, yes.
I have a note here that when they talked to Dimmock, they ruled it a suicide to say after they found out when they talked to Sebastian and they went to go talk to Dimmock because he ruled it a suicide. And he's like, did you look at the ballistics report? It didn't come from his gun, did it? And I'm like, okay, did this guy rule it a suicide despite the ballistics report suggesting that it wasn't from his gun? Or did he rule a suicide before he looked at the results? Either way, that's just blatant incompetence. Why would you rule it without the facts? Like, that's just so incompetent. It's just his ego, you know?
Fucking Dimmock.
Poor John gets arrested. And that's another example of him, like, a lot of bad luck. John meets Sarah and gets a job at that. So but we can zoom past that. Because I don't like that scene. It's so...
I think the scene is really telling and interesting. There's a lot of interesting shit in that scene.
Yeah, there is. I just don't like it.
That's kind of how I feel about the scene in the Lang Detective.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff about the show that I don't like, but I recognize that it's important, you know?
I don't have a problem with that scene, though. I can talk about it.
It's telling that John with Sarah is very confident.
One thing that's weird is that he associates mundane with like dating her. So like he's on an interview with her.
Oh,
he's
doing
an interview with her, but it's also like an interview to like they're going to start dating, right?
Right, yeah.
And she's like interviewing him and he's like, you know, see, and that's another thing is like he's applying to be a doctor, right? And she's like looking at his resume and she's like, says here you're a soldier. And then he's like, and a doctor. So he's a soldier and a doctor. His life with Sherlock is like the war. his life as a doctor is associated with him dating a woman.
Yeah.
You know, so, but I also love, she's like, you know, this might be mundane for you. And he's like, mundane is good sometimes. Mundane works. So yeah, very, very much. Yeah, I feel very good about this relationship.
Yeah, right. He's clearly just like, someone is like Sherlock, but opposite too, in a way. So I'm going to go for this. It's like, John, ugh.
No, I kind of think she's the opposite of Sherlock.
I don't know what
I think. That's why he's going for her, because she's mundane. She's boring. She's not like Sherlock.
She is pretty smart and clever and smart, but she's not like a Mary figure, exactly.
No. So I think maybe there's some degree to that, but I think that John goes for her because, like, she's the opposite. But yeah. It doesn't work out.
It is.
Because he's trying to move on from Sherlock because he thinks Sherlock rejected him. He thinks that Sherlock is not interested. So yeah, I think it's really interesting that he associate, that like his job as a doctor is being associated with heterosexuality in this moment. Mm-hmm. Because, and it sort of continues on, especially with him dating, like, or marrying Mary and meeting her at work because she's a nurse. So again, being a doctor is associated with being mm-hmm. hetero.
I do think that there is something about, we don't know because we don't actually know Sarah. Like, we don't really get to know her. But I'm guessing, and let me fully explain because I'm not getting my point across. It's like he's going for her because she seems the most mundane. I totally agree. And I think he did the same exact thing with Mary. Right? Because mm-hmm. she's a nurse. Oh, yeah. She seems, sure. It's mundane. It's easy to say the opposite of Sherlock. And then, whoops, it's kind of, they're actually more alike than I thought. And he like latches on to that aspect subconsciously. And that's why mm-hmm. when they, for potentially, this is just me like kind of guessing here. But when they go to travel together and have their sex holiday, there's like that subtext that he probably said Sherlock's name out loud, and there he's not compatible with relationships because he clearly he can only, you know, perform when he's thinking about him, but also that some part of him likes her really because she's a lot like Sherlock.
Yeah, yeah, I think there is a degree.
He'll latch on to aspects of someone that he subconsciously will like, you know?
Yeah, I think there's a degree to that.
There's that facade versus need or whatever, that idea in New York, where there's the thing that you want and then there's the thing that you need. And what you want can sometimes be the facade, where you might want it, and sometimes those things can coincide, and sometimes they're completely opposite, where the thing that you wanted is not what you need, you know? So I think that he goes for what he wants, and then he finds what he needs, and so then he latches onto that. And it just so happens that she's slightly more like Sherlock, maybe, or like Mary's slightly more like Sherlock than he originally anticipated.
I kind of think John, he goes back and forth. I think in season two, especially after he writes the blog post about how his life with Sherlock isn't compatible with long-term relationships, he starts dating a string of women, I think just to try to get Sherlock out of his system. But he starts dating women that look like Sherlock.
Right.
At that point.
Yeah. I think a scandal is where he's really can't. He's not really trying. He's not doing a very good job.
No. He's just trying to distract himself so hard, but he just can't.
Yeah.
He's just going through these women, not even giving a shit about them or remembering their names or like anything about them, because he doesn't care. And then every woman that he interacts with in season two is like you obviously want him and not me. Like, yeah. What am I doing here?
Mm-hmm.
At least the two that we see him interact with, which would be Jeanette and the therapist in The Hounds of Baskerville.
Right. Yeah. Oh, that's got a lot of implications when Henry like almost shoots her.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No. Let's not. Yeah. Talk about that.
We'll get there. But anyway, let's go back to Sarah. So another thing that is really interesting is when John comes home from the interview, and again, him associating dating Sarah with his job. He comes home and he's looking in the mirror, and then Sarah looks like, so how was the job interview? And he's like, it was great. She's great. And Sherlock's like,
She?
And he's like, the job.
He said she.
It's like, you said she. I mean it.
It.
So his job as a doctor is associated with him dating women.
Yeah.
Confirmed. There we go. And then thus begins the part where Sherlock starts to get really pissy.
Oh, yeah.
He's not pissy before this, but he starts to get really pissy at John, especially around John dating women. He gets really fucking mad about it.
It's not in this scene, I don't think, but it's later in a similar scene when they go on the date and then Sherlock says, like, oh, I'm going on a date. He said, what? And then, because he's just caught off guard, but John's first thought is, you know, like, we're people, two people who like each other, go out and have fun.
Go out and have fun. And Sherlock's like, that's what I was suggesting.
And it's like, hello, John, you idiot. He's like, no, it wasn't. John. Blind. He's blind. He's the blind pig.
Yes.
They're both blind. Sure, but John is especially blind in that moment.
I know. Then Sherlock gets all jealous, and then when they go to the circus, and then, oh, that's, I love that, when they're there, and then they're watching the circus, and then John's sitting there with all three of them. First of all, Sherlock becomes the third wheel, which is amazing. He just, like, interrupts.
Or is Sarah more?
Yeah, I know, right? Like, who's really the third wheel? because they're sitting there watching the show, and then John goes to look at Sarah, and then he, like, looks at Sherlock, and then he, like, he can't stop. Like, he just automatically, like, oh, you're there. Oh, wait, hi. He looks at, he can't help but look at Sherlock.
He's looming behind them, like, inserting himself in the middle. It's so, yeah, it's a lot. All right, let's talk about Amanda. I don't think that we kind of skip past the fact that Andy and Sulin are mirrors
Talk about mirrors. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, so Sulin, we can connect her with Sherlock.
Andy's the John mirror.
And that's, like, the clothes are a big tell. And also, like, he asks her out while she's making the tea. And she says, I don't think you would like me all that much. And then she says, I know, she just says, like, oh, I can't. And then later, you know, that's because it's so dedicated to the teapots. And yet she, like, that's putting herself in danger. But she can't go out. She can't do that to someone else.
Yeah, she knows she's in danger. It's similar to how Sherlock.
And she'll put herself in danger to take care of the teapots, but she won't put someone else. him, right?
Yeah, and it's obvious that she does like him back, but she just can't. And that's sort of the same thing with Sherlock. Like, Sherlock likes him. First, he can't because he doesn't know if he can trust him. Then it's like, well, he thinks it's not requited. But then when he does figure out it is, it's like, oh, I can't because it's going to put him in danger.
Exactly. And then our other mirror in this episode, I mean, we already talked about Dimmock, and I don't really know what I think about that, so I'm not going to go too deep into it. But Amanda is the other one. And I have a lot of notes on this. So she talks to Sherlock, I think, 2 times that we see. And she gives him, like, the receipts, and they're talking about where Eddie Van Coon went. He asks her if he was ever an appreciative boss. And she says, nah, not really. Because the only thing he cared about was a price tag. And that's towards the beginning of the episode where we get Sherlock thinking more about how John probably doesn't appreciate him and is just really there for the money for the whole episode. So he doesn't feel appreciated. And I think it's interesting the way I noticed this time, and it made me like lose it a little bit. The first time we see her, she's got blonde hair. She's wearing white, and her hair is up though. And it's like a suit jacket. So she's not a heavy Sherlock mirror or John mirror from like visual cues, but I think the fact that she's wearing a suit jacket thing is like she's kind of a blank slate, right? She's like wearing white blonde hair, and but she's got a suit jacket. So in that moment, he's relating to her because he doesn't feel appreciated. And then at the end of the episode, I noticed that she was wearing a pink shirt. So she thinks that Eddie Van Coon didn't appreciate her because he only cared about the money, but he would give her all these gifts, like Sherlock giving John the money.
Oh, yeah, wow.
For example. And then at the end, there's the jade pin, because he took the jade pin not realizing what it was worth. He just thought it would look nice on her. And then she finds out it's $9 million. And so she learns, like, oh my God, that's a lot of money. But also, he did actually kind of care about me in a real way. It wasn't about the price tag. It was just about how it looked. And she's wearing a pink shirt. So I think in my new reading of this, she's kind of both, maybe slightly more a Sherlock mirror, but I think it's interesting that she is kind of both, because it tells us more about Sherlock than it does about John, but the way that it relates to John is just to teach us and show us how Sherlock is processing where John is at. And it's not until the end that he realizes, oh, John also feels underappreciated. And then he understands John a little bit more at the end of the episode.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay, let's go back, because we skipped ahead to talk about Amanda, but we have to talk about the circus. First, I have in my notes that there was there's like when they find, John finds the writing on the wall, the painting, like a whole bunch of coding. He takes a picture of it and then goes back. And then when he circles around him.
He grabs his face and he spins him in a circle.
And he's like, John is so taken aback. He's like, he becomes so stupid in that moment. And then it takes him like a few seconds before he like comes to his senses. And he's like, oh, right. You can stop now. But he's just kind of.
It's so weird that Sherlock does that too. It's like, why the fuck is he doing that? There's no, like, that doesn't. Spinning someone in a circle does not like make you memorize something. Like why? Why did
it's so weird? Maximize your visual field. Yeah, okay.
That's not a thing.
And then there's the line. and then John says, "Answer your phone. I've been calling you." So he's getting left behind and he's getting ignored. Okay, and then they go to the circus, which we talked about earlier. So it's Sarah and John, but Sherlock tags along. And this was one thing that we don't really know what to make of, or we didn't know what to make of, and now in hindsight we know a lot about Brecht and like those influences in series 4. And Brecht, because I made another note that I noticed, when he leaves, he gets the book, or he finds the book, the London A to Z, because he bumps into that couple that has the book, and he realizes, oh, they all had that book. It's that one. because it's something everyone would have. And so he runs over and he speaks German to that couple. And I was like, oh, he has to speak German to get the book, to figure out the code. And then they're curiously at a, they go to a Chinese circus.
Wow. Ooh, yeah.
Chinese circus, for those that are listening, if you can't remember or if you don't know what I'm talking about, Brecht was heavily inspired by, influenced by the idea of the Chinese circus. And he uses some elements of that in epic theater, which is another phrase for absurdism. So any reference to a circus, I mean, in this episode, it's not really even a circus. It's like...
it's more of a theater.
But they call it a circus for whatever reason. I don't really know enough about it, but I wrote, they show us the scene. It's a play within a play in this episode. So that's setting up that concept.
I think a play within a play was a Chinese circus thing as well. I'm not 100% sure. Please correct me if I'm wrong. But
there's a lot of literature that does it, but it's a pretty common thing in Eastern like literature in that part of the world. So I don't know if definitively. I think a lot of people come up with a lot of similar things. Like Shakespeare did it too, so I don't really know. Yeah. But I wrote that we're seeing it. That's a plan and rehearsal because we see this play out and then later we also see the same thing happen. They use the same concept of the arrow.
Exactly. Oh, yeah.
Which is a callback to the blind archer.
One thing that it reminds me of in the Sherlock's convention that happened after series four, there was a theme. There was a themed like room. It was the Chinese circus theme, which is really weird because it was like 2017. How many years, like 7 years after?
Why do we care about blind baker?
Yeah, so they have a theme for the Chinese circus, which is just really weird. Otherwise, that's like right, yeah, kind of racist, like piece of an old episode.
Yeah, like why do you need to put this in here? And then the villains, like, ugh, it's just, it's, and then Sulin dies too. It's just in poor taste.
It was still a little racist, but I'm not gonna give excuses for that. But you know, everything's problematic. But it just made me think of in that specific convention. Somebody, forget who said it, but they were at the convention and Wanda Ventham was there, and Wanda Ventham being Benedict Cumberbatch's mother, and she also plays Sherlock's mother. She was at this convention and I guess she was like, she was walking over to a group of people who were there and she was just like, so did you guys watch series four? And they're like, yeah, we did. And she was like, so did you guys know what it was about? And everyone was like, yeah, yeah. And then she was like, but do you know what it was really about? And they were just like, yeah, what? Yeah. And then all of a sudden she's like, oh wait, I gotta shut up. Marquetis is coming over. So yeah. I just think that's such a great story if true.
That's so good because like I can, and I totally believe it because on top of like I know who was there because I have that post that like recounted this event. It's in our bibliography page and our blog, by the way, for those that are listening. So you can go look at that if you would like. And I am like, of course, because of all the actors in the show, those actors, they've been in the game so long, they're just like, they're not worried about getting in trouble for anything.
Yeah, oh yeah, of course. I mean, she's Benedict's mother. Of course she knows, honestly. Right. I think Benedict and Martin are really the only people in the cast that need to know what's going on.
And they are the ones that have to be the most careful, because people are listening to what they say. Not a lot of people really are listening to what Wanda says, except us. And it's kind of like, who cares if we know, because we're going to figure it out anyway. But like Ben and Martin are the ones that have to be.
From what I've known, it seems as though Benedict is not as great at it. Has a hard time keeping secrets. I think he said it before. So I can definitely see that he would tell his mom. Mm-hmm. Why wouldn't he tell his mom? He absolutely would tell his mom.
I think though that the whole cast knows though.
You think the whole, I don't know that the whole cast knows.
I don't know for sure, but maybe not the whole cast. But we don't really know who's in the room and who wasn't in the room. Because we do know that someone was quoted saying that they sat us down and explained the plot or explain the series or explain the rest of the show or whatever. They were amazed to hear about it. It brought them to tears or whatever it was. So there was some group of people that were sat down, but we just don't necessarily know who.
I think some people certain things to some degree. Like, they don't know everything. Mm-hmm. I think a good amount of the cast knew about, like, the weird fuckiness of Series 4.
They might have known that Series 4, but maybe not what it would lead to in Series 5. Because I do know that the actress that played Eurus was quoted fairly recently saying that she would love to come back for Series 5. So I'm like, are you going to come back for Series 5?
I don't think she would know, honestly.
I don't think she would know. I think she might know the role in that
season. She might know some things.
Because I feel like the way that we interpret her character, I feel like they had to tell her something. Or maybe not the whole truth, but the emotional truth.
I do know that they didn't tell Amanda that Mary became bad until she actually played that episode. Like, she had no idea. So she played the first two episodes, two episodes of Series 3, not knowing that Mary does anything bad.
Yeah, I believe that. But I think there was definitely had to have been some point when they were doing Series 4 where they had to, like, give not everything necessarily, but something.
I think
away.
They kind of understand some of the absurdism. I think they understand the absurdism aspect of it.
This is all speculation. We really have no way of knowing. we don't really know. I do think, though, that Ben and Martin know.
Of course, they have to know.
Or most of it, anyway. They know the important parts. They know more than anyone else outside of the writers. Anyway. What were we talking about?
The blind banker. The Chinese circus.
Oh, right. I think that was about it. But I don't know much. I feel like a lot of people have tried to, like, if I recall correctly, I think M-Theory involved this scene a lot. And I remember it not making any freaking sense to me.
Yeah, M-Theory was a lot.
What? I don't get it. I feel like you could overanalyze this.
Yeah, I think so too. I used to be into M-Theory, but now I kind of forget everything.
It could come back, but it's so out of context, and it would have to be really reworked for me to buy it. I feel like there's definitely something going on with Mycroft. I just wouldn't.
Yeah, I don't really know. It's kind of like,
he's a major character, so he's probably involved, but to what extent, I don't know. I think the only takeaway that I feel comfortable saying about that scene is that it's important that they put John in that scenario, not the one that's behind the arrow. Like, they confused him with Sherlock. So that's why he's in that scenario. So there's some overlap there where either people in the show or the audience perhaps could confuse John and Sherlock. Maybe Sherlock, like, this storyline is supposed to be for one character and we think it is and it's actually for the other one. Or maybe there's an overlap where really it's saying the same thing about both. Because if you kill John, you kill Sherlock and vice versa, I think. What we're supposed to take away from it, I don't know, but I think there's definitely something.
Well, there's the whole, like, I'm you, aren't I?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that too.
The twin flames.
That too. But I'm thinking, like, in The Sign of Three, where Sholto is a more obvious Sherlock mirror, but you could easily, like, because you might look at him and be like, oh, it's a soldier, it's John. But they go through the whole episode, like, you're meant to be thinking about Sherlock, but por qué no los dos? Like, it's kind of both. It's always, like, and there's always a function of here's the story in this episode and then what it's supposed to be in the larger picture. And I think trying to say one or the other is going to get hurt or killed, it's like, it's kind of both, really. We can argue specifics all day, but both of them are threatened constantly. So, yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
Right. This is our shortest record. We got off topic, but
so really short. This will be a lot funner to edit.
It's still really short.
For sure.
I do have another line, because he says, John says to Sherlock, like, how would you describe me, John? Something enigmatic.
Enigmatic.
Late. Dynamic. And then John says late. And I think that's telling. You know,
pain.
Every line in this show is just so much meaning. There's so many lines, like, that have some sort of meaning to it, where you would have a harder time finding a line that didn't mean anything.
I know, this is very true. What a show.
It is certainly the show of all time. Even the blind banker can give us all these things to talk about. I did enjoy this episode a little bit more than when I normally watch it. It's like I usually just kind of half pay attention to it. But when I really take the time, I can kind of enjoy it. It's not my favorite, but I still can appreciate it. It's ironic that the whole episode is like, we're being underappreciated.
Yeah, I know.
And then we all way underappreciate it. I think we give it its due value. We recognize what it can
do. We know its meaning, but it's not like super fun to watch.
Right. Or we're kind of stuck. I think there's some things where we could argue about and don't necessarily can't do much with, or we know that it could lead to something, but it's like it's so early on in the series that could parallel things that happen way later that we just don't really know, like, definitively. So we just kind of get stuck and then don't think about it, kind of like the TD12.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah, we just don't know 100%. We don't have really a solid like proof or evidence of something.
Yeah, we're just making associations and making connections, and there's some things that we can kind of need to figure out, but as long as we get, okay, there's something here, then when we see it, we'll be like, aha. And then if I'm not surprised, I'm sure there'll still be some aspect of it. I don't think I'll be super surprised, but I am willing to be surprised, and I'm looking forward and eager to be surprised, because even if we could be surprised, then they're just doing things in an interesting way, because you could take a lot of things that they've done and interpret it a couple ways, and I think they're going to find a way to make it surprise everyone involved.
Yeah, for sure.
Because they've been working on this for a
really long time.
A very long time. A very long time. So, all right, why don't we wrap it up? We are going to cover next time The Great Game, which very much looking forward to. That one will probably be a lot longer.
Yeah, that's a good episode.
But it's so good. It's such an important one. We're going to make, I have a note and a plan that we're going to talk about the block. And I think when we do that, might as well kind of get it all out. Like, we should just cover all of them, because there's Molly's blog, Sherlock's blog, and because at the beginning of The Great Game, towards the beginning, they talk about A Study in Pink. So they refer to
John's blog. Yeah, and there's a lot of things in John's blog and in Sherlock's blog that I think are really important to understanding the context of that first scene. Yes. And sort of the sort of emotional like tone and state of John and Sherlock within this episode, sort of beneath the surface.
And it lends to like blog theory in general.
Yes,
and
yes,
the Greek
that
game
as well.
Okay, so that's what we're gonna talk about. The everyone listening has something to look forward to. Get excited. This next one's gonna be really fun.